You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks for coming, and we do have really the great honor, pleasure, to have President Donald Kaberuka of the African Development Bank with us today. He needs no introduction, but I just want to remind you that he's about to finish his second term as head of the African Development Bank. He has restructured it, reformed it. It has become a very powerful bank, regional bank. And, of course, at the time, I mean, I won't give you all the credit, but some of the credit. At a time when Africa growth has increased, Africa has done economically very well compared to the past, and has become a new destination for investment, for interest, but of course is still facing huge challenges. Before that, President Kaberuka was finance minister of his own country, Rwanda, for 8 years. So he has a very long experience in leading both a national economy, which has also done well under his stewardship, and one of the most important multilateral development banks at a time when there is quite a debate on the future and the funding of infrastructure of multilateral development banks in the world. And in fact, on Saturday, we have a round table here of the leading multilateral development banks of the world. The discussion will be conducted. First, President Kaberuka will share his perspective with us for about 10-15 minutes. And then our colleague and the director of the African Growth Initiative at Brookings, Amadou Sy, will engage him in a conversation. Amadou has come to Brookings from the fund. He and his colleagues just completed a major report on infrastructure in Africa, and we're very lucky to have him. We also have his predecessor, Mwangi Kimenyi, who led the Africa Initiative for many years, and who's one of the really top scholars in Africa and, in fact, in the world as a development economist. So I'm very happy that both of them are here. With that done, I'm leaving the podium to you. And again, thank you for coming. I know it's a very busy few days for everyone, for you particularly, but this is a particular honor for us. And you are a friend of Brookings, of the Aspen Roundtable also, and we really thank you for that friendship and for that support.
Good morning. Thank you, Kermal, for those kind remarks. And thank you, Mwangi and Amadou, for invitation, third invitation, I must say. Now, I had a caption with me, which I didn't bring, from one of the leading African papers. And the caption was, Nigeria is back. And it really got me thinking. Because a few weeks before that, the story was one of doomsday. What's going to happen to Nigeria simply because there is an election. But such is the perception about Africa that the doomsday scenario actually was not challenged. Now the Nigeria is back. Nobody is asking questions either. Back from where? There was an election. There was bound to be a winner and a loser. And Nigeria, a great country, cannot simply be determined by one election. Nigeria would be here to stay. This is what I was saying to investors well before that. I begin with this story because I know you're going to ask me about, so what is happening to Africa in 2015? The commodity super cycle is over. Ebola is still a threat. You have energy, power outages. You have terrorism or variations of terrorism. So that is a narrative which I expect to be asked. But I want to step back from the narrative and say, the one lesson I've learned in my 10 years tenure at the bank, which I think would be acceptable to all of us here, would be that Africa is no longer the exotic market, the exotic place, as it was described for a long time. The problems are not yet resolved. They will take a long time. But that the African risk is different from the one in Asia or Latin America is the one which hopefully has dissipated. Now, in the past, what were the risks in Africa? The risks were mainly in the political arena. Confiscation, nationalization, bad policies, macroeconomic instability, and so on. And that raised the risk premium. That, in my assessment, in many countries, is over. The risks now, which we have, are mainly in the two areas. Area, what I call the cost of doing business, in all its components, energy, red tape, that kind of stuff. Risk number two, regulatory areas, either because of lack of capacity or because of implementation issues. Now, I mention this to try and put into a framework why are the African Development Bank under my presidency, we decided to focus on things we focused upon. I came into office in 2005. Now, after the G8 Gleneagles Summit, after the work of the Blair Commission, which all focused on doing some things for Africa, double aid to Africa, cancel debt for Africa. These things were very important, and they have made a huge difference. Now, the African leaders also had just crafted a new plan called NEPAD, which was basically what can Africa do for itself. These are the circumstances in which I came into office. And so as I put back and try to imagine, so what can the bank do? I made two strategic decisions, and I said so to the governors when they were doing election. I said to them, we development experts, or so we think we are, can agree on three things. That money is important, but money does not determine the outcome of development. Otherwise, Libya would be the most highly developed country in Africa. Money is an important input. This is what banks provide. But what makes the return on that investment meaningful is the quality of policies. So there is money. We need plenty of it. Always very scarce. But what makes the difference is the quality of policies. But here's the problem. But what are those policies? Because for a long part of the 1980s, 1990s, we thought we knew what those policies are. Reality is, we know what are the bad policies. We can identify them when we see them. But what are the good policies which actually combine with money delivered development? We have to be honest. We're still looking. It is a trial and error process. We're all learning all the time. And so I was not coming to the bank to join the what I call the prescriptive class. Here are the policies. Here is our money, but here are the policies. Take them together. We're in the business of learning. What is it that works in Tanzania, but which not work in Sierra Leone? What is it that works in a particular country, oil rich? What is it does not work somewhere else? That I thought it was very important, because part of the problem we have in the international financial institutions is this grand idea that somehow we know what are the policies, which make development. I think along the way we have learned, we know the bad policies, macroeconomic instability, lack of policy predictability, but actually the composition of those policies, we still have a lot to learn. And typically I give the example of the G20 countries. If you look at them, just take a look at the G20 countries, they've come to where they are from different perspectives, different angles. And each one have figured out what works for them. You can do the analysis. The third aspect, there's money, quality of policies. The third one is what is known in the business as the science of delivery, otherwise known as capacity, otherwise known as implementation. Because even in some countries where the policy architecture looks right, ability to turn those policies into outcomes varies enormously. You know, from fragile states, unable to control an epidemic, to the highly capable states, which can execute the most complex policy you can imagine. Let me talk a bit about Ebola. When you talk about Ebola, we focus on what went wrong in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Dreadful things happened, and they are not over. But step back and ask, but how was Senegal, Nigeria, and Mali able to deal with Ebola inside 30 days? They were able to do it because the very basic capacity in the primary health system exists. It's not because they have very sophisticated health systems, not at all. It's that the very basic exists, and they're able to handle Ebola inside a month, in the case of Senegal. So, I go back to say, as I came in the bank, I realized that our work is to give resources, money. Our work is to work with countries to adopt good policies, but what are those policies? And thirdly, to help with the science of delivery, implementation, capacity. Now, having made that decision, we decided to focus on the things which now constitute the bulk of risks in Africa. I said, cost of doing business and the regulatory side. So, number one, we decided to focus on the biggest issue on the cost of doing business in Africa at the moment, which is infrastructure. Because remember, infrastructure is only a means to an end. The end is the services which flow from infrastructure. The end is trade. Every single African country today, now, has energy top of the agenda. Because it's the single biggest risk for business. Many of them have to put up their own generators, provide their own capacities to self-supply. We put emphasis on infrastructure because we thought it was the biggest risk for a business. It was the biggest factor in terms of cost of doing business. Number two, we chose to focus on the size and diversity of the African market. I was saying to Kemal Davis, Amadou and Mwangi just now, that people forget, especially when you look at these average numbers, I know you'll ask me about that, Amadou, that half of all the Africans live only in 7 countries. Please remember this number. Half all Africans live only in 7 countries. 70% of all Africans live in 12 countries. And 90% in 24 countries. Please remember this number. And so, in a market as diverse as this, in a mosaic as complex as this, it is important to look at these markets as one and try to do things which bring them together. And that was the fundamental reason why the bank was created. Create Africa's single market. And so we decided to focus in the African Development Bank on bringing down the cost of doing business and on creating this Africa single market because of the size, diversity, and depth. Whether it is power interconnection whether it is highways, whether it is shared services, whether it is harmonization of policies, Schengen trap agreements, free movement of people. Because we determined that for a continent as diverse as Africa, 54 countries, this was absolutely fundamental. Third was my personal conviction that although the bank was created in 1964 to work with the countries to provide the public goods, time has now come to work with real wealth creators who are the private sector. So I came in the bank. The bank was still learning how to work with the private sector, and they were doing about $400 million per year, mainly lines of credit to banks. I thought, helped by my board of directors then, that this perhaps had to move qualitatively. And we began a program of working with private business. Now we're doing about $3 billion a year. Lines of credit, of course, guarantees, equity, debt, all kind of stuff. And we have learned along the way that the traditional thinking of the markets, the state, is an interesting academic construct. But actually, for the kind of work we do, you have to focus on both at the same time. They need each other. So right now what the bank does, we provide as much support to the states for the public goods as we do for private business to create the wealth. And finally, an area I started to focus upon was, what do we do with all these countries coming out of conflict, sometimes called fragile states? Fragile state is a fairly controversial title. But what do you do with them? For three simple reasons. A, millions of Africans live in those countries, and therefore have to help improve the human indicators, build capacities, the kind of stuff. But second, and more important, what the economists call the neighborhood effect. Especially when it's a large country, say like the DRC, for example, or the Sudan. You cannot box the problems of that country inside the country. The whole neighborhood is affected. And so we decided that we were going to figure out a way of ring-fencing some resources to deal with the specific problems of those countries in as far as human development is concerned, but also in terms of their neighborhood effects, whether it is displaced people, refugees, and so on. But the third reason is this. There is this young, I think it was a Kenyan, I've forgotten, apparently who turns up in London during the Ebola crisis. And he's asked, how is the Ebola? He says, well, but I'm from Kenya. I should ask you because London is nearer Freetown than me in Nairobi. It's not a laughing matter. It's a serious one. Because the image of Africa, its brand, the way it's perceived, is one. As President Nyerere said once at the South African Parliament, he said, each time I meet African leaders, European leaders, I'm asked, but who is the crisis in such a country? But he said, I'm the president of Tanzania. He said, it never occurred to me if I meet with Tony Blair to ask, how is the Chechnya? And he said, it used to irritate him, but eventually I said, wait a minute, but we are one. The borders were cut up by colonial powers, but at the end of the day, we are one. And so what happens in the Sudans, the DRC, in Somalia, is relevant for the whole of what we call the Africa brand. And it raises the risk premium for all of us at the same time. So we chose to focus on those countries. And I think the bank has done quite a good job there. We still have things to do, as you can see with Ebola. We have not succeeded in South Sudan or in Somalia, but it is fundamentally one of the key missions of the African Development Bank. Now, there are many things we have not been able to do, and that is for my successors. I know Amadou, you'll ask me what is my advice to the successor. The answer is none. And if I had an advice, I would not do so from here. I'll provide advice to them if they want in private, because I have some things I've learned, things who have done reasonably well, things who have not been able to accomplish, and the unintended consequences of a few things I've done. But I'm glad to have come to office at a time when Africa was changing rapidly. And so I had to be part of that. It was growing enough, but not fast enough. Remember, 5% is okay, but it's not stellar. It is not what we need. If you countries are doing 7%, 9%, 11% like Ethiopia, those are the kind of growth rates we need because of our demographics. So 4%, 5% is strong, but we have to do much more than that. And part of the solution is infrastructure, is energy, it is creating the single market. I came to office when Africa was growing fast enough, but not transforming at the same time. So fast growth, driven by investment, exports, private consumption, but not transforming the structure of the economy to create the jobs we need. Now that remains a continuing business. Third, Africa was growing fast enough, but leaving many of its children on the sidelines. And that is neither politically sustainable, economically sustainable, or socially just. And therefore, going forward, we need to maintain that momentum of economic growth by dealing with these growth bottlenecks, by not confusing economic growth with economic transformation, ensuring that the benefits spread out to as many Africans as possible. And in this year, 2015, when development is on the agenda, I hope and expect that all of us would now focus exclusively on these issues, transformation and inclusion. And so as I leave the bank, the 10-year strategy which our governors have approved is exactly focused on those issues of transformation and inclusion to create a fairer society, but also to grow the middle classes, to grow the purchasing power, so that Africa becomes part of the momentum right now in the world. I'll have time, as I close, to mention the challenges which only Africa faces now, what I call the vortex of forces operating in different directions, what physics experts call the centrifugal forces, whether it is demographic dynamics, population increase, young people, internal migration, natural resources, the disruptive impact of technology, how we relate to the emerging superpowers, economic powers, that is. These are challenges we can manage well or challenges we can manage badly, but either way, they'll be managed and they will determine for a long time what happens in the future. So I want to thank you for your friendship, for the invitation for the third time. I'm happy to answer your questions and I look forward to the conversation. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Again, thank you very much, President Kaberuka. It's the third time, and we're always honored, and it's always very informative and useful for us and hopefully for everybody in the audience to listen to you. And we're going to continue this conversation a little bit, and then we'll open the floor to questions. You've already answered a lot of my questions, so that makes my life very miserable, but I will try. So basically, I'll try to have a balance in my questions between what seems to be of interest to a Washington audience and what seems to be of interest to a more global audience, because we are under the leadership of Mr. Davis in the global department. So President Obama will be visiting Kenya for the fourth time in July. I think it's the most by any U.S. president. And he will be attending the 6th Annual Global Entrepreneurship Summit. So President Kaberuka, what advice do you have for President Obama?
The president has many advisors. I'm not an American voter, so I'd be. No, first of all, I really want to commend the president for the paradigm shift he's tried to operate vis-a-vis the relationship between the United States and African countries, which I would like to explain as follows. His approach, which I had at the G8 summit here and in his visit to Africa, is that aid is still needed, especially for the poorest countries in Africa, the fragile states, the low-income countries, who are meeting many challenges. But we need now to focus on trade and investment. And his approach, which has tried to sell to other leaders, is Africa is the continent of the future. That's where the growth in the future will be. And therefore, to try to shift the thinking of American business people to say, let American business, American public institutions work together to promote Africa as a destination for our business. That is something I fully support and endorse. And therefore, I think already the president is thinking in the right direction, and we need to encourage him and the success administration to do so. But I should add, though, that even President Obama's predecessors, they did things which made a big difference. President Bush, in particular, with PEPFAR, with the HIV/AIDS program, these were some of the things which made a huge difference in the year 2000. Remember, one of the cases to be celebrated in African development is the fact that from the year 2000 up to now, the proportion of African children dying under five have been cut by half. It is the fastest decline in human history, and in large part explained by the advances on mother-to-child transmission, HIV/AIDS, availability of cheaper AIDS drugs, and PEPFAR and similar organizations have made a huge contribution. So I wanted to pay homage to these two leaders for what they have done, one in the field of public health and human development, and President Obama for shifting the direction to trade and investment, and we want to encourage him to do so.
Thank you. Mrs. Zuma, the African Union Commission chairperson, was in town on Monday and signed with Secretary Kerry a memorandum of cooperation through which the US CDC will provide technical expertise to the AU to support the establishment of this African Surveillance and Response Unit and Emergency Operations Center. So that brings me to this question about Ebola. You've mentioned it. But can you tell us, if we look in the future, what really do we need to do on the continent to strengthen our capacity to respond to crises like Ebola and more generally other health risks?
First of all, I don't think it's only Africa alone. I think humanity going forward will be faced with many such epidemics, some of which we don't know. What will they be? So the really first question I have to ask is the world today prepared to deal with massive epidemics of that nature? And the answer is no. I think Ebola was a reflection of two things. Very weak primary healthcare systems in the Mano River area, not surprising, a region which had been undergoing civil war for almost a decade, but also failure of the international system to handle breakdown epidemics. It was a disaster. I think nobody now disputes that. So I think we have a three-way agenda. Number one, to strengthen primarily healthcare in Africa. And that's not rocket science. It's not rocket science. It doesn't require a lot of money, but I think going forward, this must be top of the agenda in every country. And we are a part of that agenda. I kept mentioning how Ebola was beaten in Senegal within a month. Senegal does not have sophisticated healthcare, but it has got a functioning basic healthcare. In Nigeria, it took about 100 physicians, from what I hear, but they contained it. Even in Mali, it was contained, because the primary healthcare is working. So that is agenda number one. Number two, we need to build, indeed, this epidemiological centers of excellence in Africa. We are supporting that. We will be part of that capabilities. But much more important, I want to say from this pulpit, that the global system of managing epidemics is broken and has to be retooled. We don't know what comes next. And I'm glad that Mr. Ban Ki-moon, I understand, has set up a panel of experts to look into how we actually retool, get the global system to function.
I should add that the Ebola crisis happened at the time, I think, where the budget of the World Health Organization was being reduced. So now if we move a little bit home, we've just finished a report looking at infrastructure financing in Africa, looking at the different sources of finance and the different sectors. And we found that in some sectors like energy, everybody's interested. We have Power Africa, we have China who's interested, we have the African government themselves spending a lot of money in the sector. We have the private sector interested too. But if you take other sectors like water, for example, or transportation, not everybody's interested. If you take railroads, only China would build railroads. So we are saying that at least in those sectors where everybody is interested, there is a need for a better coordination. And there we are suggesting that the African Development Bank should play a much bigger role to coordinate all these efforts about infrastructure financing in the continent.
Mm.
So would you buy that?
And thank you for not asking me whether I support the Asian Infrastructure Bank. Because my answer would surprise you.
That was the follow-up question.
Yeah. Look, the yeah. In this, let me focus on energy.
Yeah.
In this year, 2015, when you have got this two agenda, climate and sustainable development goals, the straight line linking the two will be the financing. It's a pity that these three processes are happening in separate strands, because they are really one. Because if you ask me today, what is the biggest single impact on poverty on my continent, I would say energy poverty. In the 21st century, there are people living in darkness. Not because there's a lack of money to build power stations, to do transmission lines, okay? Because there's market failure somewhere in between. And so, whether it is the gap in rail or highways or dams, we are now in a place where it is possible to combine sound policies, private sector investments, and actually provide a sweet spot for everyone. Now, you said the African Development Bank should lead on this. We have tried our best. We are the biggest investor in energy on the continent of Africa at the moment. But the gap is so huge, we need everybody in. Now, what has been the problem? I take you back to the 1990s and the telecommunications revolution. What has enabled Africa to leapfrog on telecommunication has been a combination of A, sound policies, deregulation in that particular sector, and then investors are looking for a return because of these new technologies. Now, of course, Africa is the fastest growing market for those products. Our own assessment at the bank is that energy is the next one. It has been hampered by policies which are deficient, you know, inefficient subsidies, not well targeted, which undermine public finances, but especially undermine the balance sheet of the national off-takers. Now, those things are being sorted out. From Nigeria to Kenya, the policies are getting to be right. The national off-takers' balance sheet are being sorted out. by different ways. The subsidy policies, tariffs, are getting the right space. And increasingly, the private businesses are looking at energy shortages in Africa as an opportunity to invest. And we are leading the way. And again, I want to pay homage to President Obama for Power Africa because it came exactly in that same space. Get policies right? Get the national off-takers to do the right things. Invest in transmission. Bring down the cost of business. And people are now investing in energy both renewables and fossil fuels, of course, which we still need. Now, you say I've got many players. My answer to you is no, we don't have enough. We need more players in the field of infrastructure in Africa. The gap of $50 billion cannot be filled even by, if you take domestic taxation, capital markets, China, natural resource-rigid contracts, we still have a huge gap of $50 billion. This is why I said I welcome the Asian Infrastructure Bank. I hope although it is called Asian, we can find ways of working together. Someone said to me yesterday, but how can you work together, the Asia and Africa? Well, let's begin with submarine cables in the Indian Ocean. We need to connect Asia and Africa. We need more connectivity and broadband. We and the Asian Infrastructure Bank decide to increase connectivity in the Indian Ocean. And there are many ways in which we can work together. So I think there's enough room for everyone. Coordination for me is not the issue. I think the key issue is get the policies right in the countries, including policies of creating energy markets across the continent. Rails, we can talk about this later. Okay. I have a different proposition. Railroads are quite a complex issue. Even European countries, I was a student in the UK when they're privatizing railways. I don't know how much success they've had, but to my knowledge, there are still some challenges there. Mm.
One blind spot that we see, though, is, if you look at the trends about urbanization in Africa, Africa has about 40% of urbanization rate. It's the fastest urbanizing region in the world. And we don't hear a lot about municipal or urban infrastructure. Sometimes it has to do also with the political economy, because we have devolution, we have decentralization. But typically in Africa, the money is still with the central government. So we are a bit worried about this trend that we are urbanizing. The demographics also are, trends are very fast, but we haven't seen a big focus on urban infrastructure.
Mm. Ask Mwangi there. I don't think people in Nairobi would agree with you. We have done quite a lot in terms of urban infrastructure. If you come to Abidjan for the annual meeting, I'll show you the most modern bridge across the lagoon in Abidjan. We are working with the Ivorian government and private sponsors. It's a 30-year concession which we have built, and it's changing the face of the city. Now, vis-a-vis urbanization, internal migration, again, it's not about money. It's about policy, getting the policies right. If we get the policies right, I think we can combine public means, municipal finance, to get some of those things you're mentioning. Could there be increased demand for almost everything, from housing to office space, water availability, and so on? So I believe that if policies are right, I think that we can close that space quickly. That said, you know, from Mumbai to Rio de Janeiro to many other cities, it's a challenge which we need to manage to create sustainable cities for the future.
Thank you. Maybe before I open the floor, open it to the floor, one maybe personal question. In 2005, when you moved to from the Ministry of Finance in Kigali to the African Development Bank, from that point on, and 10 years later, what would you say were the defining moment, inflection points that occurred to you?
That's an easy one. The defining moment for me was the day after Lehman Brothers collapsed. I usually sleep very easily. But on that night, I stayed awake for... No, the day AIG was in the news. Now, it was not about the bank. I was confident that we have got tools to ensure that the bank remains a triple rated institution. I was really concerned about what was the narrative then, which was Africa will be the first continent to suffer. Now, it was an accepted narrative. I answered about two radio stations, TV station. Is this the end of African stories? Have had it? No. I asked my staff to look at the metrics of our banking sector. You know, we sat down. You know the famous CAMO? You know, capital adequacy, asset quality, management, earnings and all this. And I found that we were doing much better than many other countries. Our banking sector was very solid. Regulation was fantastic. Maybe a bit over-regulation. But I was concerned about the secondary effects in terms of the impact on the real sector. What would happen? And so, for me, the defining moment was, I decided then to convene the African finance ministers and governors of central banks, everybody who matters in the economy. How can we do the right thing to prevent damage to our countries? And what can the bank do? And to put in place a strategy which has worked very, very well. For me, that was a defining moment. Mm-hmm. In other words, Africa had reached a point where our resilient capabilities and the strengths of the institutions were such that we can actually manage such a huge external shock. Second defining moment, the Tunisian Revolution. Because I think historians will have a big laugh. Because all of us, World Bank, African Development Bank, had held up the Tunisian model as this is how development happens. Okay? Then suddenly you have got millions of these kids in the street, okay? They're questioning things all done. The former Tunisian finance minister is here. He was working in my office. All of us were caught by surprise. Let's face it. We had to pull back, eat humble pie, and think, what is it we have done wrongly? And I recall that we then worked on a first program to support the Tunisian people with $500 million in a program called Voice Accountability and Building Institutions to try and figure out how to resolve some of the things we got wrong. I think what we call a defining moment is when you realize that you thought you knew things and now you're prepared to eat humble pie, that in fact we got things wrong. Because international institutions have an inbuilt form of arrogance. We think of answers. In this case, I was happy that we were caught without answers. And finally, the defining moment for me was that as I worked in the bank in 2005, I was the first president to be sworn in office in exile, so to speak. But the bank's HQ is in Abidjan. The bank had moved to Tunisia. I swore that before I leave office, I would return the bank to its headquarters. I didn't announce it publicly because I didn't know what was happening in the Ivory Coast. Now as I leave office, the bank has returned to its headquarters.
Thank you. You mentioned voice, so I think it's a good segue to give, to open the floor. And we have about a little bit less than 15 minutes to questions. I have one question here, two on the left, and I take questions on the right before I come back to the left. Any takers? So that's three questions, yeah, to start with. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. My name is Nia Akwete. I'm from Ghana. I was wondering if you will share with us what you plan to do next, because your record is impressive. And we need all the talent in Africa, and we ought to sideline some of them. But my real question, and I was excited about what you said about Tunisia, because I'm a democracy activist, and I was hoping when you said you wouldn't give advice publicly, I was going to implore you to give the advice publicly so that the African citizens will know how to hold the bank accountable. Give them the private advice, but also tell us on the streets what we should look for and how we should hold them accountable. Thank you.
the second question on the left there, and then the third here.
Thank you. Doug Hertzler from the NGO Action Aid. You talked about many important topics, but you didn't talk about investment in agriculture.
Investment in agriculture.
In agriculture, yes. And I know that the African Development Bank is considering financing a very large scale land acquisition involving involuntary resettlement in Tanzania, sugarcane plantation about the size of Washington D.C., and it's maybe the first of 16 planned by Tanzania. Also, the African Development Bank is involved in the Global Agriculture and Food Security Program, which is a multi-stakeholder platform involving civil society, which funds a lot of smallholder work. I'm wondering if the bank wouldn't consider moving away from these controversial large-scale acquisition projects towards things like the GASPI, or putting more resources toward the GASPI. Thank you.
We'll take a third question here on the right.
Thank you. My name is Jean-Claude. I'm from DRC. My quick question is regarding research and development. I'm a highway design engineer, and I've been following a lot of roads in Africa. As you mentioned, the issue of cost to build infrastructure is a big issue, and I would like to see how the bank can help maybe decrease some of the costs of building those roads. I know many professors in Congo have been looking into different ways, enzyme roads or different ways to do that, even on tip of energy also, palm oil to do some power plants using palm oil. Those are research and developments that I think can be helped. Lastly, how can we help the diaspora here to come back in Africa and do work? Because competition with China is really fierce, and I've tried myself actually to bid on some of the highway design, but I could not get any. Thank you.
Right. Just
I think to my brother from Ghana, the reason I don't want to give advice to my successors in public is just good behavior. You don't do that. In any case, who am I to pretend that I have all the answers? They may have better answers to some of the challenges. But if they ask for it, I'd provide it. But much more broadly, I really do think that we have come to a point in the middle of the road in Africa whereby we need to demand of our governments, of our institution, three things. Number one, that these governments must deliver the services for the people. Number two, that these governments must be clean. Thirdly, they should be accountable. I'm not saying they should be as democratic as the United States or as Finland. I'm only saying that those three things the African citizens must demand and obtain. Otherwise, good governments will look different. They'll have different architectures. But to demand that governments deliver services for which they are put in office, elected, is number one. But number two, they should not steal public money. They should be clean. And number three, accountability. For me, this is where I think the African Development Bank, the World Bank, and other institutions must insist that when we work with governments, those three are non-negotiable. Now, what form will they take? They vary from one country to another. Now, on the issue of agriculture, actually the African Development Bank does quite a lot in agriculture. But it depends what you call agriculture. You know, in many of these countries, 40% of the produce is lost after harvest because of poor infrastructure. So tomatoes are produced, bananas, whatever it is, but there's no agriculture-related infrastructure. And so I think that we have chosen that as a starting point. Let us deal with the post-harvest losses through construction of post-harvest infrastructure systems. And number two, we concluded that we cannot continue to have an agriculture which is rain-based. It's okay if there's rain and there are problems when there's a drought. Water management. And then we chose to work with other institutions like FAO, IFAD, the World Bank, who do the other side of agriculture. But we have a reporting problem. If you look at the data from the African Bank, you think we do very little on agriculture. It's a reporting problem. I think that from what governments ask us to do, We are doing much more than many other people in that area, but we have a reporting issue. Now, on land, I think there is now a charter on what constitutes land grab and what constitutes legitimate investment. And I think those principles are now widely adopted. And we are very careful that given population increase, given competition for water, that indeed countries don't alienate the land which the people will need in the future. But we need at the same time to welcome investments in agriculture. Now, funny for my friend from DRC, by the way, we are part of building this big highway from Matadi all the way to through the Kasais and Lubumbashi to Zambian border, which I think will be one of Africa's longest highways, which will open up your country dramatically. We and other funders. But here's the problem. You mentioned the cost of construction. I'm concerned by something different. We spend roughly $1 million per kilometer of highway, I think you would agree, depending upon the terrain. But a road is supposed to last for 12 years. After the fourth year, it has gone to... You have to rebuild almost every 4 years. So let us at least begin with maintenance. Now there's governance around infrastructure. Look at all these dilapidated electricity supply lines. So even when electricity is available as in production, you have got 40% commercial losses, 40% technical losses. Let us at least deal with the maintenance and governance of infrastructure. As for the rest, I agree with you.
So unfortunately, we are almost over. I'll just take one last question, and I'll give it to the lady at the end there. Balance.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Regan-Sachs from TechnoServe, and I was wondering what we can do in the U.S., American government and businesses to support good governmental policies in Africa.
Is the question, what can we do in the U.S. to support good governance in Africa, is that right?
Good government policies, right?
Here's my problem with that. Good governments is about institutions. My personal conviction that institutions can only be built domestically. I don't believe that external agents of restraint, as we used to call them, can actually promote sound institutions in other countries. It will not be sustainable. What they can do is to help, or not accord earlier, the science of delivery. A country can have very good policies, sound institutions, but it has no capacity. Capacity to collect taxes, capacity in public financial management, capacity in having a just system that functions. There, you can help enormously in terms of building capacities. But in terms of providing the landscape, the architecture of what is sound institutions governance, those things, I don't think they work anymore. But that is a personal view, which is you can help in capacity, the sense of delivery, but the rest, the citizens of each country have to work on it. They'll make mistakes. They'll fall and rise, but it is up to them to build institutions for their own country.
With those words, let me thank you again, President Kaberuka. It's been an honor. I would like also to thank your team, who have been working very diligently, to have, and our team, and of course, Kemal, Mwangi, Andrew, Amy, Christina. Thank you, everybody, for coming, and I'm sure that you found it useful. Thank you.